21, section 1. And the big idea here is that supply and demand in a market really do interact. And that as a private business owner, you have to think about these two concepts. Supply and demand in a free market system are everything. And so some terms that we, of course, demand, but also demand schedule, demand curve, the law of demand, market demand, utility, marginal utility. Hopefully these economic concepts will make sense to you because they are incredibly important, especially if you want to go into some type of business. And so our question is something that we've all probably been guilty of. Have you ever bought something just because it was cheap? I mean, let's be honest. Something you maybe didn't even need, but it was cheap. So you're like, okay. I'll get that pair of shoes that I know are probably going to fall apart in a week, but they're $5. You know, I got my sunglasses this summer that were stupid cheap, and they're terrible. But somehow they still function as sunglasses. Still wear them. I would have preferred to save up and buy some nice ones, but you know what? That cheap pair of sunglasses is somehow still kicking it. So I bought them just because they were cheap and I needed some sunglasses. So I've been guilty of it. You've been guilty of it. We've all done it. So a little intro to demand. Demand, after all, is the desire or the willingness to purchase a good or a service. Demand. As I said just a moment ago, the demand is the willingness or the desire to buy a good or a service. For example, Specialized Bikes just released their new 2018 Stump Jumper. I mean, I was drooling when I read the article about it. It looks amazing. But you know what? It's going to be like $4,000. So while it's cool to read about and look at and watch videos of this new technology that makes this awesome bike, nope. I'm good. I'm going to keep fixing my old bike. Why? Because, well, for me, it has a low marginal utility, which we'll get into in just a moment. But demand actually works on a schedule. It's called a demand schedule. It can be predicted. And this means the quantities demanded at different possible prices. When Specialized came out with the new Stump Jumper, they realized they could price it at like $4,000. And there were people out there with the money and the willingness to purchase that product. Now they know that over time, they're going to lower the price. So eventually, the 2018 model will be priced low at the end of the year to make room for the new models. They'll probably lower the price to, say, $3,000, which they know will move enough of the product to clear the inventory to make room for the new 2019 models. Because guess what? Bikes are just like cars. New ones come out every year. And that's called a demand schedule. They know how much of the product they can move based on what they price it at. They've done this research. It is a predictable phenomena. They know, let's say they can sell 10,000 units nationwide at $4,000. But once they move the price down to $2,500, they know they'll move the rest of their product. Why? Because that's how it worked last year. And that's how it worked the year before. And the year before that. And guess what? These things happen in predictable ways. Because there's lots of people like me that if it were cheap enough, I would buy it. But there's also lots of people that will buy the product at $4,000. Once more, this all happens in a predictable way. Another term you need to understand when looking at demand is a demand curve. It's a downward sloping line, and it shows the quantities demanded at each possible price. So for example, if I'm going to sell you a stapler at $10, the quantity demanded is zero. At $8, the quantity demanded is one. At $6, I could sell two of these. At $4, four of these, and so on and so on. And it is a predictable, quantifiable model. Now, it's not an exact science. It doesn't mean six will sell two exactly every time. But it means that if I do the science well, historically, six has sold an average of two. And four has sold an average of four. And two has sold an average of six over the years. And that creates a model that I can use to predict how successful my business will be. And the market research is there. You can make lots of money in the field of market research as a consultant, but if you go into private business, you will have to understand this. So, in a demand curve, quantities are shown on a horizontal axis, meaning that if you actually look at a demand curve, the quantities go outward this way. So, the more product that I move is going to go horizontally. The price ratio is going to go vertically. And all operates under the law of demand, which once more is not an exact science. Just like the law of physics means that every time I drop the apple, it's going to hit the floor. The law of demand works the same way. And that is the concept that people are normally willing to buy less of a product if the price is high, and more of a product if the price is low. And this is a universal theory that regardless of what you're selling, unless there's no market for it, which right now there's no market in this room for staplers, so I'm not going to sell staplers. But if there is a market, assuming there is one, the higher I price the product, the less of it I'm going to move. The lower I price the product, the more of it I'm going to move. It's not rocket science, but it is science. And let's say you want to sell coffee. Well, you've got to do the market research. How saturated is the market? Basically, how many coffee shops are there already? What's the relative price of your product? You know, what are you going to charge for a mocha latte? Okay, if you charge $5, you'll sell X amount. If you charge $4, you'll sell X amount in a predictable way. You know, that's why if you're even considering private business, go to business school. You'll learn this stuff in far more detail. So once more, the law of demand means that the quantity demanded and the price of a product move in opposite directions. Ergo, the lower the price, the higher the demand. The higher the price, the lower the demand. And it's really common sense. But people miss this basic concept all the time in business. They price a product too high, they don't move it, and they wind up with a store full of crap that no one wants. They then therefore have to price said crap for far lower than what they intended. They lose money on said crap. No one wants to buy it. Eventually they price it at a loss and someone buys their product. Again, look for closeouts, but also question closeouts. Why is it on closeout? Well, that means no one wanted it. Why did no one want it? Is it still something you want? If it is, awesome. Deal. If not, you should probably keep walking. So, do you agree? People often wish to buy things they are unable to purchase. I mean, come on. We all have something on our wish list, right? I mean, you know, for me, it's this kayak. But guess what? Last night, I went and fixed my old kayak again. I took it out, broke it again, fixed it again. I double fixed it this time, so maybe it'll work better. Because honestly, I fixed it real good. I mean, both sides, welded, patched, etc. Maybe it'll continue to float for a while. Because I can't afford one. But I was hanging out with a friend of mine who's a doctor, and he broke his boat at the same time, and guess what? He's a doctor. He's like, meh, no big deal. I'll buy a new one. And I was like, must be nice, Mr. Doctor Guy. Market demand is the total demand of all consumers for a product or service. Because if you're going to open a coffee shop, well, number one, you can understand that people like to buy coffee. And that, yes, people will go and pay $5 for a cup of coffee if it's good. I'm not going to go into the gas station and pay $5 for a cup of coffee. No. I'm going to the gas station to pay 50 cents to get my mug filled. I'll go to Starbucks and I'll pay $5 for a pumpkin spice latte when it's in season. You know, that's the market demand. What's more, market demand means the total demand of all consumers for a product or service. Now, am I looking, you know, the question is, what is the market? Who is my market? You know, if it's just you guys, then I realize that the demand, the market demand for staplers is zero. So if I want to sell you on something, well, I've got to know my market. What would you guys buy? Oh, yeah, prom tickets. Maybe half of you are going to prom. Awesome. I hope you do. It's going to be a great event. Prom tickets. Knowing my market, your high school students, you want to go to prom, ergo prom tickets. I'm pricing them to sell. I'm keeping them low at $25 because I want you to go. I know that if I price it at 50, less of you will go. I know that if I price it at 100, almost none of you will go. We keep it at 25 because we want all of you to go. Does that make sense? You're the market. You're not going to buy staplers. You will buy prom tickets. Yay. That's the market demand. The total number of prom tickets that I will sell. Now, how do I figure this out? Well, it's not easy. I don't just make up a number out of the top of my head. I do some research. What have other schools charged? What percentage of their population attend based on price? There's research on that. Now, we priced ours purposely not to make a profit, but we priced it so that you will attend. Because we understand that if we priced it at 50, whether you wanted to come or not, you're just not going to be able to. And if we price it at 100, no one's going to show. So we priced it at 25. Again, that's common sense, but there's a science behind it. You can make money in that science, or you can benefit from that science as a business owner. So, how are we going to figure this out? You know, here's where the money is made. Number one, if you're going to open a coffee shop, you better be a patron of a lot of coffee shops. You better know the industry in and out, because being a private business owner is a risky venture. You need to have worked in the industry already for a long time. You need to know it in and out. You need to be able to make every type of coffee there is. You need to be able to understand how pricing works. You need to also be able to understand how to create a demand for your product. You know, so Bryce opens up a new coffee shop. Let's say it's here off of Spartanburg Highway. Yay, Bryce's Coffee. Well, what sets him apart from other local coffee shops? I know there's one downtown. They make great coffee. I love that place. So why am I going to go to Bryce's shop versus the one downtown? You know, what's he going to do to create a demand for his product? So number one, visit other shops. He's going to figure it out. He's going to know the game. Secondly, he's going to pull consumers. You know, who is his market going to be? If he's locating on Spartanburg Highway, well, then he's ideally going to market to people who drive down that road. So he needs to figure out who's driving down that road. Probably residents of Henderson County. You know, if he's going to locate off the interstate, that could be anyone in the state of North Carolina. But since he's on Spartanburg Highway, once more, he's dealing with a much smaller pool of consumers. And so he needs to study data about how consumers will react to prices. And then figure out how to communicate those prices to his consumers. Does all he need is a sign, Bryce's Coffee, people will flock to it? Unfortunately, no, that's not how business works. He's got to attract that market to get them to come into his shop. Because when I'm buying coffee, I'm thinking utility. Utility means the amount of satisfaction one gets from a good or a service. When I make coffee every morning, I'm just trying to wake up and get it through another day. Let's be honest. I hate getting up. It's like automatic. I'm on autopilot. I'm making my coffee. All I really need is the caffeine. The hot beverage is kind of nice. It's comforting. The taste is okay. But really what I need is that caffeine. It gets me moving. So my utility for my morning coffee is the amount of satisfaction I get. But the question is, am I getting the satisfaction from just the caffeine or the quality of the coffee? For me, personally, it's the caffeine. It's the hot beverage. It's just the comfort I get from drinking something hot. So that's my utility. The pleasure a product provides. But here's the thing, utility is relative. You know, for Bryce, it might be that he has a higher utility on the taste and the quality of the coffee. Where did the beans come from? How were they ground? How were they roasted? You know, did he grind them himself? Did he use a French press? Did he use a percolator? Did he just use your old standard Mr. Coffee? You know, how it's made might be very important to him. Ergo, he might have a higher utility on the fancy stuff versus the cheap stuff. Again, not all objects have the same utility. People. There's also another principle we can understand, that diminishing marginal utility is the additional use that is derived from each unit acquired. So for me, let's say that I bought 2 cans of cheap coffee next week instead of 1 can. 1 can usually lasts me about a month, so I'm buying like the big giant can. Anyway, so let's say I bought 2 big giant cans. Well, that's not going to change the amount of coffee that I drink. The marginal utility for me of coffee is static, meaning that if I had 20 cans of coffee, I'm still only drinking that thing each day. That's not going to change, because if I drink more than that thing each day, like heart palpitations, like anxiety, like I'm basically a wreck. So I know that thing, that is my marginal utility. It is not changing. But for some people, it might be different. Like, let's say, you know, what are those shoes called again? Vans. Thank you. So let's say Cameron finds a sweet deal on Vans and she stocks up. She gets 10 new pairs. Well, here's the thing, full price, she might buy 1 pair in the next month. Sweet sale, she'll buy 10. Okay, great. 10 for the price of 1, why not? And so she's going to do that. And she understands that the better the price, the more the product she's going to buy. So for her, the marginal utility with increased consumption actually results in a lower level of satisfaction. Here's the irony, is that if she only has that 1 pair of Vans, they're really important to her. But if she's able to have 12 pairs, then each pair's value diminishes relative to the number that she owns. Does that make sense? Like, if I have 10 bikes in the shed, each individual bike means very little. Since I only have 1 kayak, I have 1 and then an old one as a spare. But I only have 1 designed to go down the hard, scary stuff. And to me, that boat means an awful lot because it's the only one I have. When I break it, I fix it. But my doctor friend, he's got like 6. And so he took his broken boat out without fixing it yesterday, and I was kind of upset. I was like, oh man, like that hurts, like just watching you destroy this boat. That it doesn't mean a lot to him because he's got a lot of them. But to me, I'm just like, oh, you know, I can't afford to fix mine. Like, I might be able to afford a new one in a year. But he was like, no, I'm buying one tomorrow. Okay, whatever. You know, different strokes. I should have gone to medical school, I guess. Whatever. So, as prices fall, consumers buy more of an item. You know, if these kayaks were cheaper, then sure, it wouldn't be a big deal to me. I used to work in the outdoor industry. Once upon a time, I got really cheap boats because I was a professional in the outdoor industry. At that time, it wasn't a big deal to buy new outdoor gear because I got it really cheap. But now that I'm no longer involved with the industry, I have to pay full price. Ergo, I don't buy as many. When they're cheap, I buy more. When they're expensive, I buy less. And guess what? That's how most people work. It's a predictable pattern. And so as a business owner, think about that. So would you buy a second copy of an item that you already have for the exact same price? So here's the question. If you don't need the product, but you just want a second copy of it, an exact copy, would you pay the same price? Most people would say no. 21 section 2 today, still on the subject of supply and demand. And once more, the big theory here is that supply and demand in a market interact with one another, and that is how price is determined. So in a free market economy, since price is a variable, since supply is a variable, then we've got to think about this in terms of how price relates to demand. And there's a couple terms we need to understand today. Number one, demand elasticity. It's a fancy term that if you go into business, you need to know. Again, substitute and then complement. How do these fit into economic decisions? First question is, do you think that people should wait a certain period of time before making a purchase? I don't know about you, but I do this almost instinctively. If it's something big, I'm going to obsess about it. And so several different factors can cause market demand for a good or a service to change. So what can affect demand? We already know that price certainly affects demand, but what else can affect demand? So demand changes over time for a product due to many different factors. For example, if more consumers enter the market, there's going to be more demand. You see, right now, none of you guys have heard of Confluence Manufacturing out of Greenville, South Carolina, because the market base, the number of consumers of whitewater kayaks, is very small nationwide. Mine's still considered a fringe sport, and that's okay. I like it that way. But if suddenly you guys all got super excited about whitewater kayaking, then the number of consumers in that market would grow, and that would affect demand for that product. When they make the latest and greatest new model, they understand that a limited number of consumers will buy their product. So, other changes that can affect demand. Well, if your income goes up, yay, congratulations, you got your first grown-up job. What are you going to do? Well, you're probably going to want a new car. Yay, everybody wants a new car. What else are you going to want? Well, probably going out to eat more. You know, I've been broke college student. I've lived on, you know, broke college student rations. When I got grown-up job, I was like, sweet, I'm going out to eat all the time. And now we're regulars at our local Mexican restaurant. And that's where we've settled. And we're really happy with that. And that's something that our income affects. When we get a raise, we go out to eat more. When we're struggling, we go out to eat less. And so finally, expectations. Expectations affect demand. You know, if the Switch is coming out now, well, it better be good because its competition is pretty fierce. Now, the Switch represented a new niche, meaning that it's a hybrid device. It can be both a console and a mobile gaming system. So it's a relatively new phenomenon. But that also puts it in two different markets. It has to compete with the console market, which in terms of hardware, it's way behind on. And it has to compete with the mobile gaming market, which it's really kind of ahead of the game on. But since it's in both fields, well, expectations are rather high. Next, prices of related goods can change. Okay, so there's the Switch and there's the 3DS. They're both very excellent gaming systems. They both have an impressive library of games that go along with them. And so since the 3DS is admittedly cheaper right now, that is going to affect demand to some degree. The beauty of this is that it can all be predicted and analyzed. And that if you're a good business person, you have to know how to do this. That's why if you plan on going into any kind of business, you need to go to business school. You need to learn how to track market demand through a curve. I gave you a simple project, the supply of the jelly donut thing. You guys got an intro to that. But if you really want to do market research particular to your line of business, you use the same methodology. Okay. Changes in population can affect demand. More consumers obviously means higher demand. The larger the population of our country, the better farmers will do in terms of the agricultural sector, because we buy most of our food indigenously. Most of our food comes from this country. Ergo, the larger our country, the more food we need. That's a simple one. Same with gasoline. Population of nations affects demand and gas prices. When more people in China are driving, the price of gas goes up. When the global economy goes down, the price of gas goes down because demand goes down. Fewer consumers means lower demand. You know, yesterday in world history, I was teaching about the bubonic plague. It's a really creepy thing. The Black Death killed tens of millions of people, really hundreds of millions of people globally. And we have this, economists are the way they are, and they've studied the Black Death. Of course, we all get that it was creepy, it was terrifying, hundreds of millions of people are dying, but economists looked at it in terms of market factors. And what they realized was that suddenly, workers were in an all-time high of demand. And that because of the Black Death, wages went up. Yes, wages went up. Why? Because if you're living in a little medieval village, and the town blacksmith and his apprentice and his son, you get the picture, and they're all dead, the market demand for a blacksmith is at an all-time high. If you want to be set for life, go be a blacksmith where all of them are dead because of the bubonic plague. So anyway, fewer consumers means lower demand. This can also be affected by immigration. Yes, when folks come into our country, they have to eat just like everyone else. And so that affects the value of food and the demand on food. They've got to drive cars too, and so that affects the price of gasoline. They also have to work, and that affects the labor pool. All of these factors can be affected by population change. Right now, our country is experiencing a post-World War II phenomena of it's called the graying of America. That is, that people are living longer, we're having fewer babies, ergo our population is older than it ever has been. What does that mean? Well, that means in Brevard that the Blockbuster went out of business and they put a dialysis center in its place. I mean, that's what that means. You know, what does that mean? That means that smart business people are realizing the demand for products and services that benefit the elderly. And so if you really want to be a savvy business person, think of a product or service that will benefit elderly people in Henderson County. Boom, that's the money right there. Changes in income certainly affect things. High wages give people a higher level of discretionary income. Low wages give people less money. So strong economies result in booming businesses that serve luxuries. Strong economies will see a rise in jewelry, in luxuries, new cars, fancy electronics, etc., etc. iPhones are being marketed. The latest and greatest iPhone is being marketed to a population that can afford the expenditure of the latest and greatest. Also changes in taste. You know, what we have to realize is that you can actually create a demand for a product. You know, if any of you have been scrolling through your social media feed and you see an ad for something you've never heard of, But you start to see that ad more and more and more, and suddenly you begin to want that thing. I've been guilty of it. You see, marketing today is extremely clever. You know, advertising companies gain access to your browser histories, and they use that information to target you particularly. And so if you've been looking up cool journals, you probably see ads in your social media for cool journals. If you've been looking up stuff about the Switch, I bet your news feed is full of stuff about the Switch or video games or whatever. And mine is. I mean, even when I'm looking up like how to get through this stupid puzzle on Zelda, it's recording that I'm looking at that, and it's already figuring out what to sell me next. The internet knows I bought Zelda somehow, and they know that I would probably buy a game related to Zelda, so they started sending me Skyrim stuff. Well, what did I do? I eventually bought Skyrim. It's cool. I started having to Google, like, how to solve this Skyrim puzzle, like, what to do with this thing, where do I put this dragon, whatever. And suddenly, there's a higher utility for that game where I'd never even heard of it prior. But guess what? Popularity fades over time. You know, right now in mobile gaming, Fortnite is pretty up there. But guess what? It's got its moment in the spotlight, and we as a people will be over it soon enough. When I started at the early college, kids were obsessed with Clash of Clans. They pressured me into getting it. Okay, I started playing it. 2 years later, I was over it, as were most people. Most of us have moved on with Clash of Clans. Now people are on Fortnite. Guess what? In 2 years, you guys will be super seniors. The incoming freshmen will be like, oh, Fortnite, that's so stupid. You know why? Because popularity fades over time. It's just one of those laws of economics. Finally, change in expectations. Knowledge about future products affects demand. I knew that when I bought the Pixel 2 would come out within about 9 months. I knew that. I knew this sucker would become obsolete within a couple of years. And that did kind of knock the excitement out of it to some degree and will certainly affect future buying decisions. Global events can influence demand. Guess what? When a Democratic president is elected, anybody want to guess what market sees a huge surge in popularity? Guns. When a Democratic president is elected, gun sales go up significantly. If you want to make a smart investment, if it appears that a Democrat is going to win in 2020, invest in guns. Buy some stock in Smith & Wesson. It's almost a sure thing. Worry about future events influences demand on certain products. You know, if we're going to go into a war, I mean, God, I hope not, but if we go to war with Syria, like, I think it'd be terrible, but anyway, if we did, buy stock in Halliburton. Who's Halliburton, you say? Oh, they're they're a military contractor. They're mercenaries for hire, basically. And they're one of the primary groups that we use when we don't have soldiers to deploy. So a lot of the folks in Iraq right now are private contractors. So if we go to war, buy stock in Halliburton. It's a pretty safe bet. Worry about future events affects demand. But also product-related changes. Anybody ever have a favorite restaurant who changed their menu or changed the way they made a thing and now it's no longer your favorite restaurant? Mm-hmm. I mean, hey. Like, for example, restaurants to avoid raising prices will often either change ingredients or reduce portion size over time. They do this so they don't have to raise prices. But that affects quality and that can affect demand. but also changes in substitutes. Substitutes are competing products that consumers can use in place of another. If the competition comes out with a better product, then you're less likely to buy the product that you had once used. You know, when I started teaching, I know it was a million years ago, the iPhone had just come out. It was the smartphone. It was the only smartphone. If you wanted a smartphone, you bought an iPhone in 2007. Otherwise, you had the brick. Well, I was stubborn. I stayed with the brick. I used my non-smartphone. Why? Because the price of the iPhone was too much. It was more than I was willing to pay. However, over time, Android has arisen to be a viable competition. And so, since Android's gotten so amazing, that eventually influenced my purchase. Whereas in 2007, I bought the fanciest iPod because I wanted a way to listen to my music. So I bought the fanciest one I could find. I don't even need an iPod anymore. This thing has all my music on it. Yay. So, as price of a product goes up, demand for its substitute will also go up. So, when the iPhone 7 was released, it was nearly $1,000. The iPhone 8 is now, what, $1,000? Somewhere around there? Is it still $800? Okay. I mean, I guess you can get the fancier version with more storage or whatnot. Basically, if you get the tricked out one, it's going to be pushing a grand. Well, guess what? You can go buy LG, you know, decent phone for $200. So that's the real question. You know, do you want LG decent phone for $200, or do you need latest and greatest? You know, and your decision there will be partly affected by price. And what economists can measure is that the higher the iPhone gets, the higher the demand for LG decent phone gets. But also changes in complements affect demand. That is, a product that is used with another product. So when I bought the Pixel, I understood that it wasn't waterproof. Had I known the next generation would be waterproof, maybe I would have been patient. But I wasn't, so I didn't. Well, that meant that in order to have a waterproof phone, I had to buy a LifeProof case. Well, the LifeProof case for the Google Pixel, for me, was an essential accessory. And so the LifeProof is a complement product. Meaning that if I didn't have the Pixel, I wouldn't be buying the LifeProof. So computers and software are an excellent piece. When I bought the Switch and the internet realized that I own a Switch, it now tries to sell me games for the Switch. You know, it wants me to give... Lately, it's really been pushing Xenoblade. I've never even heard of it, but it's probably just going to push it, and I'll finally give it a try. So again, that's a complement product to the Switch. So as demand for the Switch goes up, demand for its software will also go up. Now, the beauty of this is these things can be tracked. That folks who are making Xenoblade Chronicles are looking at Switch sales. Should they make a sequel? Should they release the sequel? Should Doom 2 be ported to the Switch? Is it worth the time and effort to do it? Well, they're going to look at Switch sales to make that decision. Next, elasticity of demand. This is something important. Demand elasticity is the extent to which a change in price causes a change in quantity demanded. So, demand elasticity means that if the change in the quantity demanded, to what degree does that influence price? So, we know that demand affects supply. We know that demand affects price. But to what degree? Does one more consumer raise the price by X amount? Does 100 more consumers raise the price by X amount? If Switch sales go down by 50% this year, to what degree will that affect the price drop? I'm sure you guys have heard about the drama related to the Wii U. You know, Wii U sales were far lower than projected. That means the price drop happened much sooner and was far more significant. So, causes of elastic demand. Number one, attractive substitutes. You know, if the Switch had serious competition, there would be fewer of them sold. Also, do you have the ability to postpone a purchase? You know, do you need this new phone? Does everyone need this new phone? Or is it something that everyone could choose to wait on? You see, some demands are inelastic. The example I love to use is medicine. Did you guys know that the price of an EpiPen recently skyrocketed? So if you are in a situation where you have to carry an EpiPen, it's now far more expensive. Was there anything that you can do about it? If you have a deadly allergy to bees and you don't get that EpiPen, you will die. Bottom line. EpiPens expire, ergo you've got to buy one of those things probably every year. So the price of them went up from, I don't know, less than $100 till now they're way more than $100. Well, here's the thing. The really crappy part of that is that you don't have a choice. What, you're going to not buy one and risk death? That stupid bee that's under our school is going to get you and you will choke and not breathe and you will fall over and die. Or pay $150. That's called inelastic demand. Demand for luxuries are always more elastic than demand for necessities. You see, if the price of milk goes up, I'm still going to buy milk. Got to have my cereal in the morning or I'm not happy. You know, to me, that's a necessity. Or the price of gas. I have to drive. I live 16 miles from here, so I have to drive to get here. The price of gas will not change that. And so that's inelastic demand. I mean, relatively. If it goes up too much, I'm riding my bike, but whatever. Talking about chapter 21, section 3, once more, the big idea is that supply and demand interact and that price is determined from the demand on a product. And that these studied, they can be measured, ergo they can be predicted. And so that business doesn't have to be as risky as the guesswork that you might feel that it is. It can actually be scientific. You can go into a business and be reasonably assured of your success based on careful research. It's not a guessing game. You know, so as we learn about these terms, you see that they all relate to supply, since we're going to be learning about the supply curve. Now, the first question, do you agree that producers should always provide a greater supply of a product than they think they will really need? You know, since I was obsessing about the Google Pixel when I bought this, by the way, Zelda's on my wallpaper. Anyway, that's why I got the Switch. But back to the Google Pixel. When I was obsessing about this, there was a supply problem from the very beginning. Google purposely did not make enough of these products to meet the demand. Now, why do you think that is? Why would they make fewer of these products than they were predicting the demand for that product to be? What's the advantage for them? Early on, when this first came out, let's say they made 1 million units. Well, let's say demand for the immediate released item was 2 million units. That means perhaps they can keep demand high since supply is artificially low. Now, they could have easily made 2 million units, but they didn't. And so maybe that keeps demand at a higher rate. Maybe it's a good business strategy. So really, businesses can do this any way they want. Let's say that they project demand for this product in the first 3 months to be 2 million units. So they make 1 million. Maybe that works out better for their profit margin. Think about supply. You know, supply, the definition is the quantities of a good or service that producers are willing to sell at all possible market prices. The lowest this phone ever got, I'm going to guess and say it was about $500. Now they stopped making them. In fact, they don't even make this phone anymore, and it came out in fall of 2016. Less than 2 years later, it's already off production. Why? Because they have now sold all the units they projected. Sales have essentially equalized. They've now sold all the ones. People have bought all the ones that they want, and now they've discontinued production. And so supply for this has gone down to essentially zero. But supply, once more, is the amount of goods and services that producers are able and willing to sell at any price. So when this phone first came out, well, I waited a few months for the first price drop, but when it first came out, it was rather expensive. And then after the first price drop, it was a little less expensive. The final price drop put it down to about $500, and then they discontinued it altogether. Well, supply of the Pixel means everything from the original price down to the lowest price was the supply of that item. It is the opposite of demand, because the law of supply states that suppliers will normally offer more for sale at higher prices and less at lower prices. The idea, if you're making anything to sell, is that you want to sell the most of your product at the highest price possible. You only market to close out when you need to get rid of them and make room for a new product. So that's why the MSRP on a product is the manufacturer's suggested retail price. That's the price point that the manufacturer has estimated will generate the most profit for the retailer. Eventually, retailers, to generate sales, will offer discounts off the MSRP. So the MSRP is the highest price point because that's what suppliers want to sell that item at. And they will. They'll sell X amount of items at that price point. But eventually they're going to need to lower the cost to move their product. And so their hope is they'll sell as many as they can at the highest price point. So as prices go up, so do the supply of goods. As prices go down, so do the supply of goods. Meaning, at the higher the price, the higher the supply. It also means the higher the price of an item, the more the manufacturer wants to make of that item because they want to move it at that price point. But as the item goes down, the supply is going down. You know, the all-time peak of manufactured Google Pixel phones was towards the beginning. They were making as many as they could because they were selling them like hotcakes. 3 months ago, the supply was at an all-time low because demand was at an all-time low, as well as price was at an all-time low. This can be charted, and this is watched closely by any private business worth their salt on a supply schedule. A supply schedule is a table showing the quantities supplied at different possible prices. So Google projected to make 2 million units and sell them for about $700 a piece. I don't know the real price, but theoretically $700 a piece, 2 million units. But they also planned, say by February of 2018, to introduce their final price drop down to $500. And they knew at that point they would only be making about 100,000 units. Because at that point, demand had essentially fizzled out. Now they're pushing the Pixel 2. The Pixel 3 will be out probably by October. Now, this is an interesting question. How much do you think a diamond's worth? To be fair, what is a diamond? Would you call it a luxury or a necessity? So raise your hand if you think luxury. Obviously, it's a luxury, right? One of my best friends just got engaged, you know, of course, the traditional picture of the girl's hands all over Facebook. Now everybody's super excited, you know, they're getting married soon, it's gonna be great. Well, she got a diamond. Why? Well, because that's traditional. You get a diamond engagement ring. You don't have to. You can get something different, but it is often the custom to buy a lady a diamond engagement ring. I'm victim to it too. You know, okay, we were going to get engaged. She got a diamond engagement ring. You know, I could have got her something else, but hey, that's the tradition. Who am I to fight custom? So I got her a diamond engagement ring. I understood, however, that diamonds only have value because we ascribe value to it. It actually has no inherent value. Gold, at least, is a great conductor of electricity. Diamonds are a very efficient cutting tool, but in terms of decorative use, the only reason they cost so much is because we buy it. The only reason it's priced so high is because people will pay that for it. So, diamonds cost more than water. Water is essential to survival. Yet, currently, water's cheap. What's the difference between the two? I'm sorry?
Marketing.
Part is marketing, yeah. I mean, you want the diamond. This is not diamonds, gold, but you want the diamond. Some good marketing. What else? How about scarcity? What about supply? Which do you think there is a higher supply of, water or diamonds?
Water.
Water is relatively plentiful. Maybe not someday, but currently it is relatively plentiful. Certainly compared to the diamond. So it's not a necessity. Get into the relationship between scarcity and demand. So the law of demand, that is special. We can chart these through tables and graphs, can show also the law of supply. So what do these graphs and tables look like? The first one I want to talk about is a supply curve. That is the upward sloping line that shows the quantities supplied at each possible price. So we know the higher the price, the higher the supply. And so the upward sloping curve in a supply curve shows the higher the price, the higher the supply. Higher the price, higher the supply. We even go into business. We go into business to make money. Let's be real. You know, I would love someday when I retire to work at some type of outdoor shop. I don't know, take people kayaking or something. Some fun little thing, maybe be a mountain bike guide. I don't know, some kind of outdoor guy. Well, that's great. I'm not going to volunteer my time, though. My time is my own. I'll sell my time. Why? Because I want to make money doing it. Ideally, I want to make money doing something I love. You know, Victoria wants to have a catering business. And someday, 10 years from now, I'll call up Victoria's catering business and say, hey, you want to do our prom? And she's going to go, sure, $1,000. Okay, fair enough. She's going to do prom because she thinks that that's cool. That's what she wants to do. She loves catering events. I'm going to solicit her services because I like food and we got to have food for prom, so it's going to be great. It's a win for both of us. But she's not just going to do food for prom because she loves food. She's going to ultimately do it to make money. Because who knows? She might have children by that point. She might have relatives that are working for her company by that point. You never know. But she'll have to make money. Otherwise, she can't do it. And so the profit motive is going to push her to make money above cost. Because here's the thing. Let's say, so we're trying to figure out, Victoria and I are haggling over prices. And she's going to say, well, I can do it for $10 a head. That's a fair price for a catering event, $10 a head, okay. So let's say I call up Hannah Flanagan's. I know they'll do it for $7 a head. So I'm gonna call Victoria back and say, hey look, Hannah Flanagan said they can do food for prom for $7 a head. Well, she's gonna tell me, that's great, you should probably go with Hannah Flanagan's. Why? That means she's losing potentially a big contract. But on the flip side, if she undersells and goes $6 ahead, she knows she's going to lose money. So she's got to keep that price point in order to make money. Even though she loves food, she's got to make money. And so she's got to keep her profits above her cost. Otherwise, she goes out of business. Now, Hannah Flanagan's might be able to run it at $7 because they have a different supply schedule than she does, or they have a different way of doing things. Whatever it is, her price point is $10. Otherwise, she loses money. Now, let's say we work it out. I go, okay. Turns out Hannah Flanagan's food is not as good as yours in terms of quality, so we're going to go with the $10 ahead. Awesome. It's a win for Victoria. It's a win for me. Better food. She gets the money. Now, what is she going to do with that money? So let's say out of the $1,000, let's say it actually cost her $500. Well, now you're thinking, wait a second. If she's making double off of what she's producing, why couldn't she have done it for $7? Well, here's the thing. What's she doing with that $500? Well, she's probably got a shop set up. She can't legally run this out of her house. So she has to have a location. That means rent. She can't feasibly do all the catering for Henderson County by herself. She has employees. So after all the bills have been paid, her business is making $100 off this prom. So she's now made $100. Her business, that's after bills, after everything. What's she going to do with that money? Well, here's what I've seen bad businesses do with that money. She could splurge. She goes, sweet, I made $100. I'm going to buy this cute outfit. Okay, that's one thing. Yay, lots of cute outfits. Well, okay, that's one thing. It would be a lot smarter to take that $100, invest it back into her people, back into her business, maybe more space. Let's say someday she's going to want to expand beyond just Henderson County. I mean, you've all seen this, and it's exciting when it happens. Like, my favorite Mexican restaurant in town is Papa's and Beer. I mean, oh my gosh, it's just great. I can't help it. It's not healthy. I love it. So, Papa's and Beer, good food. They have more than one location now. Did you know that? They have a place in Asheville. I think they even have a place in South Carolina. They've done that. Why? Well, because the more of those big fat burritos they make, the more money they make ultimately. And that's their goal. They have a profit mode, just like anyone else. So maybe as her catering business takes off, she wants to open up a location in Greenville. Yay. Maybe she wants to buy new equipment. So here's the thing, to do food for the prom, and let's see, what type of food would you make? Okay, so mostly Ukrainian food. So let's say you have a small oven. You start out with a small oven. Well, that limits the amount of food you can make. I mean, theoretically, that maximizes production at a certain point. Bigger oven, more production. More production, more food. So she's going to want better equipment. More workers, obviously, too. Two's better than one. If she's got two people doing the job, she can now double her output as well. Of course, she could keep the money. I mean, she could say, I've expanded to the degree that I want to expand. I'm going to keep any excess profit from here. I'm good. I don't need to expand anymore. That's fair, too. All right. Her business will be driven by market supply. That means the total of all the supply schedules of all of the businesses that provide the same good or service. So Victoria is going to think very carefully before she starts this catering company. The big question is where? Is she going to do it in Henderson County? Is she going to do it in Greenville? She's going to do a lot of careful market research. Because guess what? I don't want to burst your bubble. There's other catering companies in Henderson County. Now, are there any other Ukrainian catering companies that you know of?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to your knowledge. So that might be your niche. That might be it. You know, maybe there's a demand for Ukrainian catering in Henderson County. We do have a large Ukrainian population here, so it's possible that it could be successful. But before she commits, she's going to be a smart businesswoman and do the research. You know, is there theoretically a larger Ukrainian community per se in Greenville? I don't know. Could she make it? Maybe it's worth a shot. Maybe she tries it here and then decides to locate where there's a larger market supply to increase her profit. So, it follows individual trends. Meaning, since she wants to make specifically Ukrainian food, she's catering to a specific market supply. Now, granted, the you and I's of the world might say, I'm not familiar with Ukrainian food, so I might say, hey, I'll give it a shot. You know, let's try it. And there might be enough of the me's in the world to say, let's try it, to give it a shot. And that might, you might just be introducing Henderson County to Ukrainian food. You might just be that pioneer. And that's incredible. So again, it follows individual trends. I can't predict how her business would do. But the upward slope shows that she's going to try to sell her item. As a smart businesswoman, she's going to try to sell her product at the highest possible price. So when I'm calling her up for prom, she might originally quote me at 12 bucks a head, knowing that we can talk down to 10. She'd love to do prom at 12 bucks a head because, again, that would generate more revenue. That would potentially lead to an extra $200. Here's the thing. The $100 of profit, what if that could be $300 of profit? That's three times the amount of investment that she can put back into her business, or three times the amount of outfits that she could buy. The most important factor in this is price. So when we're thinking about a specific Ukrainian catering business, we're dealing with a limited market supply. You know, who's the market for this? But here's where it gets really complicated. What if there's a competing Ukrainian catering company? They're making the same food as her company. That's where things get really tricky, right? So how do we figure that out? Well, now they're making the same food, assume same quality. The only X factor is price. So what economics teaches us is I'm going to go with the cheaper company. Sorry, Victoria. She's small. She can't afford to keep her profit margins thin. So this company is going to basically bid her out of business. They're going to take up all the business in that market supply. They're going to push her out. She's going to have to find another place to do business. It's sad. It's cold. But that's how it works. So again, the most important influence when everything else is the same is price. If you were a business owner, what would you do with your profits? It's something you have to think about and consider very carefully. If you pay your workers better, maybe they're happier, maybe that increases output. If you invest in more equipment, again, maybe that's what you need. What happens when there are changes in supply? Different factors can cause increases and decreases in overall supply. Number one, the cost of the resources. Well, let's assume that anybody else going into business? We've picked on Bryce and Victoria an awful lot. Anybody else want to be brave and be an entrepreneur? Okay. Let's say Alan's going to open a bike shop. He likes mechanical stuff. So let's say he goes into some type of mechanical thing. So here's what he's got to deal with. Well, the price of parts go up every year. Price of bikes go up every year. Somehow they magically go up every year. So as the cost of the resources that he needs to do his business go up, guess what? Supply goes up. Why? Well, because Specialized just released their new stump jumper. It looks amazing. And they're selling that sucker for a lot of money. Well, it's in Specialized's best interest to make lots of those bikes so that they can sell them at the highest possible price point. It also means that demand right now is not as high. So they're making lots of these products hoping to sell them, but with the understanding there'll be a price drop in a month or so. So when the price If a resource goes up, supply falls. Now this is where it gets a little trickier. Let's say, okay, Specialized released the new stump jumper. Let's say the cost of aluminum goes up. Well, that means it's going to cost them more to make each individual bike. Ergo, they're going to make less of those bikes. Productivity is a major factor in measuring supply. Productivity means the degree to which resources are being efficiently used to produce goods and services. Waste affects productivity. You know, last set of notes I ran off for U.S. history, I made 2 extra copies, just wanting extras. Well, that's sheets of paper, that's ink, that's staples that are wasted by the county. I didn't use them, I even ripped one up for illustration in first period. So that's a waste. That hurts efficiency. If I could go fully paperless in this classroom, that's less paper that we have to buy, ergo, that increases efficiency. Productivity. So when productivity increases, costs go down. When productivity decreases, costs go up. Henry Ford didn't invent the automobile. He made it cheaper. How did he make it cheaper? He invested in labor. He maximized efficiency in production. He made more cars with less money than anyone in the world had been able to previously. And that's why he's a household name. He emphasized productivity in production. Another one is technology. The methods or the processes used to make goods and services. Henry Ford was actually a technological innovator when he developed the assembly line technique to manufacture the automobile in a cheaper way than had ever been done before. That was a new technology. It lowered the cost of production. It increased supply. Why? There were Model Ts rolling off the line like hotcakes, and people were buying them because they were cheaper than any competing automobile in the world. One is government policy. Why do you think the cheapest t-shirt in the world is not made in the United States? Why don't we make the cheapest? If we're the best country in the world, why can't we make the cheapest t-shirt? Yeah.
Because we have
wage laws. Right. We have minimum wage laws. So that's going to be one significant barrier to the world's cheapest t-shirt. I mean, really, like $4 a t-shirt, you got to pay some kid 10 cents to make that happen. You're not going to get that on $7.25 an hour. What else? What's another barrier? Why don't we have the cheapest t-shirt? We've already got to labor. There's more than that. What do you think, Bryce? Paying some kid 10 cents, we've established that. What else? Could there be any environmental factors in making a t-shirt? What happens if you dump dye into a stream? Is that good or bad?
Bad.
That's bad, right? So, do you think we have environmental laws here? What were you going to say, Al?
Like buying the materials could be too expensive.
Ooh, materials could be more expensive, yes. Because maybe the supplier of those materials has to follow rules here that are going to keep those costs high. Maybe over there, let's assume over there, that the company can dump all the dye they want in the rivers and no one cares in Malaysia. Let's assume that people can pay their workers 10 cents an hour and no one cares. That government policies. Sometimes government can restrict supply as well. Governments can certainly tax production of certain goods. And taxes have a relationship on supply of a product. Basically, higher taxes generally lower supply. The higher it costs to make a product, the fewer of them we're going to make. Lower taxes increase supply. The lower the tax, the lower the cost to make a product, the more of the product we're going to make. So the government is very involved in our economy. One way is through subsidies. A subsidy is a government payment to an individual, a business, or a group in exchange for certain actions. Let's say that you are going to be a corn farmer. That's your thing. You're super excited about growing corn someday. Been there, grew up with a garden. It's not that exciting, but maybe for my dad, he loves it. So you're going to grow corn. Yay. Well, if you're a big enough corn farmer, you can qualify for federal subsidies, meaning that someone is going to pay you to grow corn. Why? Well, you got to have corn. I mean, if you eat French fries, you're eating something made through corn oil. Certainly popcorn, certainly any product, cereal, often made from corn, corn bread, corn meal. So, subsidies make it cheaper for you to do business, meaning you're going to grow more corn, which is good for everybody. We've got to have corn. So when it lowers production cost, supply goes up. When subsidies go away, supply goes down. So here's the thing. Government shows up and they say, tell you what, we're going to pay you $100 a year to grow more corn. You go, sweet. What are you going to do with that money? Well, once more, here's your options. You can go buy a cute outfit. You know, imagine farmer in overalls with cuter overalls. I don't know. You can go pay your workers better. That might increase output. You could buy better equipment. Maybe you want to save up and get that fancy tractor. Who knows? What you, with all the things you can do, it's going to inevitably translate to more corn, which is what our government wants, more corn. That's why they're paying you. So what is the expectation? Well, producers may adjust supply to meet expected demand. You know, the Wii U was a failure business-wise. It just was. Why? Because they made far more units than the actual demand. They overestimated the projected demand of the Wii U. And so they made too many of these things. They couldn't sell them. They had to lower the price significantly. It affected their profit margins. There were concerns that Nintendo was going to go out of business because of the Wii U. The Switch has really revitalized their company. Okay, the number of suppliers. This one's pretty obvious. The more suppliers you have, the more supply of your product. And what I'm talking about here are, for example, let's think about how the stapler is made. It's made primarily of aluminum, a little bit of rubber, and that's about it. The two items I need, aluminum and rubber. So oil and ore. So if the amount of oil producers goes up, there's going to be more staplers. If the amount of oil producers goes down, there'll be less staplers. It's that simple. It really is. So, the fewer oil producers, because by the way, rubber comes from oil. So the fewer oil producers, ergo, less oil, which translates to less staplers. Okay. So which of these has the greatest impact on supply? Short answer, they all have impacts on supply, but you can decide for yourselves which one you think is the best. Moving on. Yes, supply can be elastic. It's called supply elasticity. This means that it measures how the quantity of a good or service changes in response to price. Changes in response to a price. Well, number one, it depends on the speed in which producers can adjust supply to meet higher prices. Well, let's say that suddenly everyone wants a stapler. Oh my gosh, they're taking off. Check this out. Did you know that home flipping is at an all-time high? If you want a lucrative business, now is the time to get into house flipping. I mean, every day when I drive to work, I pass signs saying, we will buy your crappy home at whatever price. Why? Because they want to flip it, and they know in Henderson County they can sell it, make lots of money. It's a lucrative business. And so as demand is going up, people are like chomping at the bit to get into that market. Everybody wants real estate right now. It's exciting, but it's also concerning for something we'll get into in a moment. So basically, elastic supply means homes. Inelastic supply means we can't easily add more when prices are high. So homes are a little tricky because to build a home is going to take a few months. So even if you know that the home market is booming, you can't just hop on a train and build more homes by tomorrow. So that's a relatively inelastic supply. So that's why you have everybody going, we will buy your crappy home, because we're dealing with a limited supply of homes. They want to take your home, they want to fix it up, and they want to sell it at a profit. Elastic supply, that's something that we can run off more units of easily. So let's say that the price of frozen pizzas is going through the roof. Well, it's easy to make more frozen pizzas. Boom, run off more. Bam, you got frozen pizzas. Awesome. That's elastic supply. Okay, and which of the following would be hardest to increase quickly? Which do you think? You know, my guess would be gold. Like, okay, more beef, we grow more cattle. 6 months, we got more cattle, more beef. Water, well, you just gotta find more water. Corn, okay, but gold, I don't know, it's a little more scarce. Or we're learning about how supply and demand interact with one another. And of course, the big idea here is that these determine price. They determine how much of something is sold, and they interact together in a way that can be predicted, that can be analyzed, that can be studied, and that can make starting a business a lot less risky than it has to be if we play it smart. We'll see today our surplus, shortage, equilibrium price, price ceiling, price floor, as well as minimum wage. So the first question, do you think an economy would work if everything cost the same price? So if you were paid in widgets, that's the economic term, so if you're paid in a widget, that is you get one widget per day, and if everything in the world just cost one widget, would that even be feasible? So, let's think about this. So, how do prices work in a free market? Since we're a free market, that means supply and demand work together to establish prices. For example, if there's a surplus, that is a situation in which quantity supplied is greater than quantity demanded. It's also a situation in which a government spends less than it collects in revenue. So if there's a lot of something, the law of supply and demand indicates that the price is too high. Ergo, the price needs to be lowered. None of you want to buy my stapler for 10 bucks. I have a glut of supply, a surplus. Common sense would dictate I need to lower my price to meet the demand, which we found out that the demand is basically I would have to pay you to take a stapler. So there you go. The price meets the demand. But also, if there's a shortage is a situation in which quantity demanded is greater than the quantity supplied. This means that I've priced my product too low. If I said, who wants to buy my stapler, and you all raised your hand, I have 3 staplers, I have 10 customers. Well, that's good for me. So what I'm going to do is say, okay, 10 bucks. Your hands are still up. Just like an auction, I'm going to say 15 bucks. Your hands are still up. Price is going to continue to grow until I've reached equilibrium, until I've set a number and there's 3 hands. And in a perfect market, that's how it works. That's called equilibrium price, when there's a perfect balance between the supply and the demand.
It's theoretical.
I mean, you don't always find the perfect equilibrium price. But if you do, man, you're making money. You see, equilibrium price is the price at which the amount producers are willing to supply is equal to the amount consumers are willing to buy. If you've ever worked for a private business and your shelves are empty at the end of the day, it's a satisfying feeling. You know, when I worked for a rafting company and all of the boats were rented out for the day, even though my income wasn't based off their profit margins, even as a lowly hourly employee, it was still satisfying to see that we have reached a market equilibrium. The price we were charging was fair, ergo the demand was high, and we were at maximum capacity. Sometimes renting these out two or three times in a day, sometimes sending 600 to 800 people down the river in a day. And it was neat to be a part of an efficient operation that I knew was making money. It was job security for me. The boss was also really nice to us when he made lots of money, so I enjoyed seeing their business thrive when the price was at an equilibrium. Now, it stays. So if it costs $30 to rent a kayak for the day and take it down the river, assuming that the demand remains consistent, there's no need for that price to change. But if the demand goes down, well, they've got to start lowering the price. But what we found over time was the demand steadily grew. Ergo, we could begin to experiment with charging a little more just to see what happened. Now, there is a degree, even in a free market, of government control over prices. If there is an unfair balance between supply and demand, the government may establish a price ceiling. A price ceiling is a maximum price that can be charged for goods and services, and this is set by the government. For example, when there is a fuel shortage, gas companies want to start charging outrageous prices because they know that people will pay it. So if there's a shortage, there's going to be a line at the gas station. Well, you notice also during those shortages that gas stations don't just start charging $10 a gallon, because the scary thing is people would pay it because they got to drive their cars, they got to get to work, they got to go places. And so in those times of crisis, our government will establish a price ceiling. But also there can be an opposite crisis where a price floor is necessary. A price floor is where the government establishes a minimum price that can be charged for goods and services. So an example of this, let's say that demand for an essential product is at an all-time low. Think of agricultural goods. During the Great Depression, demand for agricultural products hit an all-time low. In fact, 400,000 farmers lost their homes because they couldn't sell their crops. They couldn't pay their bills. 400,000 farmers lost their homes as a result. One attempt to combat this was the price floor, where they established a minimum price that farmers could charge for their product, and that was to help them stay in business. One practical example of a price floor that you guys have experience with is minimum wage. Minimum wage is the lowest legal wage that can be paid to most. Now that's the key, most. As you know, restaurant employees that make tips can legally be paid far less than the minimum wage. But for most workers not earning tips, minimum wage is the law of the land, which is a great example of a price floor. Now, should the government control prices? Should price floors and price ceilings be established on all products? It's a matter of opinion. Prices as signals. Even to the consumer, prices can be signals that can help you make good decisions. You know, if you are a business, well, what do you want to make? You want to go into business? Great. You know, the idea of business is to make money, hopefully doing something you enjoy. But what are you going to make? Well, you can think about what you want. So let's think about what you want. Let's say you love bikes. Okay, you want to make bikes. Well, what kind of bikes are you going to make? Well, you should be somewhat influenced. If you're a good business person, you'll be influenced by price. What types of bikes are selling for lots of money? Which ones have the highest profit margins? Where am I going to make the most money selling bikes? It's also going to determine how you produce it. So if you want to manufacture the bikes or you want to retail the bikes, how are you going to do it? Well, price affects that. If you're selling an item with a thin profit margin, you're dealing with high quantities so that you can keep your money flowing in. Now, if you're dealing with luxury items, that's also going to deal with how you produce it and who your market is. That is, for whom are you going to produce it? And so prices are signals. So what advantages do prices have? Well, number one, they're neutral. You know, you've heard the old saying, it's not personal, it's just business. You're not trying to hurt anybody's feelings when you buy one water bottle over another. You know, let's say you walk into the store and you see the hydro flask and you're like, hey, that looks really cool, but it's 40 bucks. Really, 40 bucks for a water bottle? Are you kidding me? No, you're going to pick out the cheaper one. Are you worried you're going to hurt hydro flask's poor feelings? No, hadn't even entered your mind. Sure, they're a neat company. Sure, they do cool things to the environment, but 40 bucks for a water bottle? And I'm not considering their feelings. I mean, really. They're neutral. They're also flexible. Now here's the thing, somebody is out there paying 40 bucks for a hydro flask. Good for them. There are other things I pay lots of money for, just not for water bottles. There are things that you pay lots of money for. Maybe they are water bottles, maybe they're not. But those prices are flexible. You see, the price system is able to absorb shocks, that is, sudden changes. If no one bought those bottles, they can lower the price and eventually someone will. It also allows freedom of choice, and this is an essential part of our country's system. If you want to buy fair trade coffee, and if that makes you feel better, knock yourself out. If you want to buy the cheap stuff made by slaves, buy the cheap stuff made by slaves. Now, of course, by slaves, I'm saying that these coffee grounds may be made in countries that don't pay their workers a living wage. That's your choice. Or if you prefer to go with the fair trade route and buy coffee that comes from places that pay their workers a living and sustainable wage. I mean, that's up to you. It's freedom of choice. You can choose to buy products purely based on price. You don't have to consider price if you don't want to. You are free to buy what you want. And this is the opposite of a command economy. A command economy means that instead of, hey, where do you want to go eat tonight? No, it's, we're going to eat at this place because we have to eat at this place because that's the only place that we can go eat. But also prices are familiar. You know what it costs to get the products that you love. You're aware of those prices. You know the going rate of your favorite thing. It's not a secret, nor should it be. Are there advantages to the lack of choice? One of our favorite restaurants in Brevard, it's called Magpies, I'm a fan anyway. One of the neat things about their menu is there aren't many items on it. So instead of some restaurants, you know, we go to El Chapala at least once a week and their menu's like pages and pages and pages because there can be lots of combinations of the same ingredients and so there's a complex menu. But if you go to Magpie, well, there's about 4 to 5 options when it comes to entrees. There's maybe 10 different options when it comes to sides and that's it. So limiting choice can also be a way to run a business, but there might be advantages to that in a command economy. But once again, that's a matter of opinion.